Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, principal teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, the nuts and bolts of cultivating attention.
I want to touch on these two topics. Let's start with the practice that we're doing right now, which is essentially a Mahamudra approach to shamatha. Now, there's a lot of terminology that flies around in Buddhism, which I don't think is particularly helpful. Some of it's even traditional terminology, badly translated. What I'm thinking of here are things like shamatha with support and shamatha without support, or shamatha with an object, shamatha without an object, form meditation, formless meditation. Any of you heard any of these terms? Yeah. People get wonderfully tied up in knots about them. The purpose, or what we're aiming for at this point, is cultivating a basis of attention. And for some people, that is more easily done if they use a reference point, such as the breath, or a actual object. And for other people, it's more easily done if they don't use an object. What's important here is to focus on to keep the intention. And the intention is to cultivate a base of attention. Now, there's only one way to cultivate a base of attention, and that is to do something which requires some attention, doesn't require much thinking, and do it over and over again. And one can liken cultivating a base of attention to learning scales in music, or if you're using a wind instrument, learning how to blow the instrument, a nice even tone, or if it's a string instrument such as a violin, learning how to draw the bow. It's a basic skill. There's nothing particularly magical about it. And the way you do that, any of those things, is you just do them over and over again. Now, when you do them over and over again, you make tons and tons of errors. You know, you miss notes in the scales, or the bow wavers, or your breath isn't steady, or whatever. But when you're doing that, you don't regard that as a problem. You just say, okay, that's how that is. And then you do the next one. And little by little, things get better. Now, how many of you beat yourself up every time you fall off the breath? Or there you are sitting in open awareness and you fall out of it, and then you beat yourself up, right? How helpful is this beating yourself up? I'm going to send Ralph to Raton and ask him to get a good supply of baseball bats so that everybody, whenever they fall off the breath, they go bang, bang, bang. Pardon?
I said gladly.
Many people approach meditation practice as they would approach SAT or a GMAT or something like that. They have this one chance to get it right. It's a practice. And the thing about a practice is you expect to fail. You don't expect to do it perfectly. And that's why you're practicing it, so you get better at it. How many of you approach meditation this way? Everybody's trying to do it right all the time. It's a practice. So you fall down, fall off the breath, fall out of attention time and time again. So that's the first piece that I want to convey this evening. It is approach this retreat as practice, and fall out of attention, okay? Start again. And you just do this again and again and again. And there's a saying in Chinese, that to learn how to do something, do it 10,000 times. That's all. You don't worry about the first 10,000 times. After that, if things aren't coming together, then you can get a little concerned. But not for the first 10,000, okay? Something to keep in mind, because I suspect this operates in a few of you. Who are you trying to impress with your meditation practice? Janet? But you got to impress somebody, right?
Yeah.
Not quite sure who, but there's somebody there that's going to be impressed. And I'm going to make sure that they're impressed with my meditation practice. So, the nice thing about meditation practice is when you finish, nobody gives you a round of applause. And you think that this is funny, but this is how many people practice meditation. As if, you know, they're on stage, they've got to do it perfectly, and then when nobody gives them a round of applause, they're kind of miffed afterwards. Where's my recognition? Okay. So it's a practice. You're not going to impress anybody. The consequence of that is you can completely relax in this. You want the deep, dark secret here? You're the only person who's going to notice if you don't do it perfectly. Nobody else. But that's not how we approach it. Now, some of that comes from an idealism, a yearning for an ideal. This is also very problematic, and it's encouraged very, very highly in most Buddhist traditions. I mean, you have in the Zen tradition, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. And reactive emotions are infinite, I vow to release them all. The gates to the Dharma are infinite, I vow to enter them all. Awakenings are limitless, I vow to engage them all. Nothing idealistic. One of the things that we've lost in the West, and this is really, it's died out about 100 years ago, is the use of formal language and mythic language in how we communicate with each other. The four vows that I just recited, which is the form the Bodhisattva vow takes in the Zen tradition, this is mythic language. It serves to inspire, to move emotionally, and you don't take it literally, because it doesn't make any sense, literally. We grow up in the culture, into modern culture, postmodern perhaps, in which the intellect, thanks to the likes of Descartes and others, was placed above reason, above emotion. To some extent, this goes back as far as Aristotle, but it really gained ascendancy in the what's now referred to as the Enlightenment, which it wasn't. But, in which reason was seen to be the ideal. And this led to, you know, several generations of people repressing their emotions and so forth. And a lot of good came out of this in one sense, in that there was, and it came out of the development of the scientific method and the use of reason as applying to understanding the world. And when you're working scientifically, whether it's in medicine or physics or biology, whatever you read, whatever you write, you intend it to be taken absolutely literally, because you're trying to describe things very precisely. And when you read an account of a scientific experiment or a diagnosis of a disease or what have you, you read it absolutely literally. It's not poetry, it's not symbolic, it's not mythic or anything like that. And over what's now a few hundred years, this has been the primary way we relate to things. We've lost that to a large extent, being able to talk about things symbolically. Indirectly. And I had a very explicit experience of this when I was having a conversation along these lines with a psychologist. And he said, well, what do you mean this mythic language? And I said, well, in Tibetan Buddhism, it says regard your teacher as Buddha. And before I'd even finished the sentence, he said, so he's infallible, right? I said, perfect. That is the literal trap that you fall into. It doesn't at all mean that your teacher is infallible. That's taking it literally. What it means is that, for whatever reason, you regard this particular person as how you experience awakened mind in the world. That's what it means. That's how you experience awakened mind, is through this person that you come to learn and understand and come into connection with awakened mind. And that is one of the primary functions of the teacher, is to reveal awakening to the student. But that has nothing to do with infallibility. That's another projection, modern projection, on the notion of being awake. It's that you're perfect, like some kind of Superman. Thank you, Nietzsche. You see, this is where all of these ideas come, and they're laid on top of these traditional teachings.
Here's a question from Brian in Los Angeles. Recently, I read a book about the practice of shamatha meditation. The author asserted that, quote, Tibet's great meditators of the past claim that the achievement of shamatha is necessary for all forms of advanced meditation to be fully effective, unquote. Also, I've spent years doing Gurdjieff work, and his teaching seems to emphasize developing a similar kind of stable attention, as does Vipassana meditation. All this makes me wish to develop this quality of sustained attention. However, my current practice involves recognizing the ongoing, changing nature of experience, even if my attention wanders and is weak and never seems to improve in stability. There's a deep letting go of having any expectation or judgment of the quality of my states, and I find this quite freeing. So my question is, does one need to develop a stable, solid form of attention? And does shamatha play a role in your teachings?
Well, let me start with the last question first. Does shamatha play a role in how I teach? Yes, it does. The quotation, and you point out the Gurdjieff work and Vipassana, what these people say, or these traditions say, is quite true. One needs to develop the ability to rest in stable attention. And usually I encourage people to start cultivating that through just resting in the experience of breathing. Now, as they do so, they find themselves doing exactly what you describe, recognizing the ongoing changing nature of experience. But you keep coming back to that resting quality, resting in the experience of breathing. You find that the mind, or the heart, because it's the same, actually becomes quiet. In the beginning, it just becomes quiet for short periods. In the monastic traditions, one tried to hold on to that stillness or peace. I find that in the modern urban environment, that almost inevitably results in some form of suppression and is not healthy. So what I encourage people to do is to return to that resting and return again and again, and then it naturally stabilizes so that they can rest for longer and longer. In that quiet, stable attention, you may be aware of thoughts and sensations and emotions. They may come and go, but it doesn't disturb the quality of the attention. We say that attention has two components. One is one of resting with the object of attention, whether it's the breath or a visualized object or whatever. And the second is quality of knowing what's going on, knowing whether the mind is active or dull. And when those two qualities are present, that is, you're with the object of attention and you know what's going on, that is attention. I would also suggest a possibility here. You say your current practice involves the recognizing the ongoing changing nature of experience. What recognizes that? And can you rest in that? Maybe you'll find a way to cultivate the attention, the stable attention there.
So this is from Dave in California. He says, "My own current life situation is not conducive to a traditional cushion top session. Instead, I rely on a few specific daily activities to focus practice upon. Nothing so difficult as taking a breath when passing through a doorway, but simple, regular, daily acts nonetheless. So far, the practice has allowed me to rebuild a very basic foundation, at least insofar as bringing back the same discomfort and challenges experienced during my own past sitting experience. How would you recommend cultivating attention for those who are not able to keep a regular sitting practice?" That's the first question.
Well, perhaps it would be helpful to look at this as a stage of practice. From your question, I understand that you did have a sitting practice. You now feel that your life circumstances don't allow you to sit regularly. But there's something there that is meaningful and important to you, because you keep making some kind of effort. Simple acts of attention, if I understand you correctly, though nothing so difficult as taking a breath whenever you open a door. I find it interesting that you characterize that as difficult. Basically, practice is about the cultivation or the development of attention. And anything that we do that helps us to cultivate attention will be helpful in our practice. You also note that even with the little efforts or the small efforts that you're doing, you're still encountering the same kind of discomfort you experienced when you were doing sitting practice. Our lives are largely run by avoiding experiences we don't want to have. And we constantly rearrange our lives so that we don't have to experience certain things. In doing so, we necessarily introduce an imbalance in our lives, because those experiences are part of our lives, and if we're not engaging them, opening to them, then we are, in effect, avoiding our lives. This is an imbalanced situation. So when the discomfort arises, just experience it. It may only be for 2 or 3 seconds, just touching it, moving on. But even that effort, just touching it and moving on, is going to bring about a process of change. It's going to start changing your relationship with the discomfort, because little by little, you will discover that, oh, I can experience this. I don't have to avoid it. And now you've gained another dimension of freedom in your life. Many people try to do too much too quickly, so I would advise you to just pick one area, work on that for a while. When you can do that, then move into another area. So there's a sense of constant expansion of your practice. If you have 1 or 2 activities which help you to drop into attention, then add a couple more. Work with those for a few months, then add a couple more. And you may find, strangely enough, through this process, that a point comes where you may actually be able to
do a sitting practice again and have that much more available. But the practice is really just about bringing attention to whatever it is we're experiencing in each moment. And as long as you're making that kind of effort in some way, then you are following a path.
So more specifically, he asks, if a person successfully builds a reasonable foundation in attention in a non-sitting practice, evaluated, of course, by someone other than oneself, are there ways to execute some of the other meditation techniques off the cushion, for example, the four immeasurables, the Dakini practice, taking and sending, and even Mahamudra?
In theory, yes. And as Yogi Berra says, or said, in theory there's no difference between practice and theory. In practice, there is. What's key here in what you're asking about is intention. Reactive patterns are not dismantled. They don't fall apart fortuitously. In fact, the nature of reactive patterns is to create conditions in which they are progressively reinforced and strengthened. So we have to be the active agent. And if you find that you've been able to build a way to come back into attention consistently in your life, then within that framework, you can bring in the practice of equanimity or the practice of loving kindness, and eventually the practice of compassion and joy, which are the four measurables. I think it's a little more difficult to work with the Dakinis, though you may find that momentarily flashing on the Dakinis, or the earth Dakini or the water Dakini, so that you touch into that energy and allow that to inform or augment the level of attention that you have, you may find that helpful. Certainly, once you understand how Mahamudra works, it's possible to practice it, but that usually requires some fairly serious training. But you can always do something like, just by introducing the question, what is experiencing this? Whatever you're doing, you just say, what is experiencing this? And if you become adept, train yourself essentially to rest in the space that that question opens up while you continue with whatever activity you're doing, then you have a form of practice. One of my students is a jazz singer, and I gave her the question, who sings? So while she was performing on stage, this was where her attention was, on who sings. And one day, one evening, while she was performing, everything disappeared. The song continued, but she was no longer on the stage. And she said it's quite an incredible experience. So, is it possible? Yes, but it requires a consistency of effort, which can only come from a strong intention.
This is Steve in Los Angeles. Ken, since I've started practicing over time, we've talked about practice off the cushion and developing awareness throughout your day, and I certainly have noticed more of it, whether in Dzogchen, Rigpa, or whatever you do, people, every time you go through a door, there's definitely a sense of greater awareness throughout the day of what's around you. I was thinking the other day, about a month ago, I came home from a long day of work, and got on the couch and the basketball game was on, and it was really great to just completely space out and watch this basketball game. And not facetiously, I thought about, is there a place in our practice where we don't strive, where we take a vacation from, or do the equivalent of watching that basketball game, where it's okay to know, okay, I don't want to know anything else that's going on. I don't want to be aware of my peripheral vision or sounds. I just want to space out.
You just want to space out.
I just want to rest from whatever that experience is. It's an experience that feels differently. It's an experience of real rest. It's a different kind of experience than cultivating an awareness throughout the day, I find.
Well, your question arises because your life is out of balance. And I think most of us here in Los Angeles live lives that are out of balance, so that there are so many demands, we're having to put so much out, that sometimes we just want to rest. The body needs to rest, the mind needs to rest. And those are not ideal conditions for the cultivation of stable attention. It's one of the reasons why people who are really serious about their spiritual practice tend to live fairly simple lives, so that they can be working at it all the time without trying to compensate for the through very deep fluctuations of being totally on and then totally off, which is how most of us function in an urban environment. So that's where I think your question is coming from. If you're able to cultivate a life where you weren't totally drained by your work, then when you came home, you wouldn't have the same inclination to be just to be totally rest and just, as you say, space out for a while. So I would say it's more a question of bringing more attention to the balance in your life so that you are able to make a consistent effort rather than the off-on thing that you're experiencing now.
Well, maybe I should not use the word space out so much. Let's take a different example. If I go to see the theater, the experience is richer if I'm not paying attention to the exit signs and the person three rows in front of me. The experience seems most enriching and connected if I'm right in that piece and not aware of those things.
Perhaps. But if you're at the theater, you might try doing the ecstatic practice that we've, so you're not focusing on the exit signs or the people 3 rows in front of you, but you're in the whole experience of being in the theater, including, of course, the stage that's being performed. I mean, when you're listening to a concert, you do the practice by listening to all of the instruments and not just picking one and following its line for a while and then picking another and following its line for a while, which is more or less how most of us listen to music. But you actually listen to the whole thing. A doctor that I used to work with, or used to work with me, when he learned the ecstatic practice, he went, found himself at a, he liked classical music, and he was listening to this pianist, and he said it was a totally different experience, because when he opened it up like that, he could hear exactly what the right hand was doing, exactly what the left hand was doing, could hear them almost distinctly, and at the same time experience how they were interweaving together. So it became a much richer experience for him. So the more that we open to our experience, the richer our experience becomes.
Okay, thank you.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.